Hello. In tonight's Quantum Leap, how our bodies no longer fit the world around us, March winds in spring weather, and a Dublin pub audience learns how they might one day grow their own replacement bones in a laboratory. All that's still to come. But we begin with a brilliant new light source that's just been switched on in the Oxfordshire countryside in England. It's called the Diamond and it's a synchrotron. It produces not just a superb bright light but also X-ray and infrared radiation. And scientists are queuing up to use it as a microscope that will allow them to peer into the very fine structure of materials. Well, joining me now on the line from London is Dr. James Randerson, a science correspondent with The Guardian newspaper. James, can I begin by asking you first, what is a synchrotron?
Well, essentially it's a kind of particle accelerator. And what that means is it's a huge donut-shaped thing in the in a field in Oxfordshire. It's about 5 football pitches large. And what it does is it fires packets of 10 million electrons around this ring at close to the speed of light. The ring itself is 500 metres in circumference. And as they whiz round, they fire off radiation at kind of an angle to the ring. And the scientists can use that radiation to do various useful things. But the really remarkable thing about this, about Diamond, is that it's the most brilliant light source in the universe. It's brighter than the sun, and it gives off radiation in a great variety of wavelengths. So not just invisible light, but in X-rays and gamma radiation, all sorts of things. So it's incredibly useful for scientists for studying very small things.
I presume nobody is looking at this very brilliant light source, but they're actually just taking it in as a tool. What kind of things are they doing with it?
Yes, it would be an extremely bad idea to look at it directly. And so, yeah, it's all about channeling that radiation very precisely and firing it at what you're interested in looking at. And the really cool thing about it is that you can look at all sorts of things that are very small. And one example is looking at individual proteins within cells. One of the things scientists are interested in is trying to work out why it is that certain cancer cells, certain cells within the body go on and divide uncontrollably to form a cancer. And that involves looking at the proteins within those cells, trying to understand their structure. And you can do that by firing X-rays at them and then looking at how the X-rays bounce off those proteins. And then you can look at that, what's called a diffraction pattern. You can go back from that and work out what the structure of the of the protein was originally. So that's one use. There's also some people at the Natural History Museum in London who are looking at the molecular structure of a meteorite called Santa Catarina, which was discovered in 1875 on an island called São Francisco off the coast of Brazil. Now, this is the remnants of a planetoid that apparently blew apart around 150 million years ago, and it dropped down to Earth sometime between 10,000 and 100,000 years ago. And by looking at the structure of it and trying to understand how it was formed, it should tell us a bit about the history of our solar system and our universe.
Intriguing. So everything from what makes a cancer cell cancerous to the structure of the solar system.
Indeed.
It sounds like a pretty expensive facility that I presume took some time to build. What kind of money are we talking?
Well, it's big money, actually. It's the most expensive UK science project, and it's over €1 billion, the cost. It's actually a joint project with a similar device in France called Soleil, which obviously means sun. And out there, their synchrotron is sort of configured slightly differently, so it's kind of useful for different kinds of applications. And the idea is that there'll be lots of exchange of scientists between the two, and they'll sort of complement each other.
It's a little bit like a very small version of CERN, the nuclear particle research facility on the Swiss-French border.
Yes, that's right. I mean, actually, synchrotrons came out of particle accelerators originally, if you like. I mean, with particle accelerators like CERN, in fact, what they're building at the moment is something called the Large Hadron Collider. Those things, they whiz these electrons around and smash them together, and then you look at the kind of the detritus from those collisions, and that tells you about the structure of subatomic particles and what atoms are made of. Now, while people were building those things, they had this problem that the electrons were slowing down because the radiation was flying off and that was giving off energy, and that slowed everything down, which was a problem. But then people said, well, hang on, we can use that phenomenon in another way. And so people started building particle accelerators like that are synchrotrons that were designed in order to maximize that effect and use the radiation rather than smashing electrons together.
Excellent. Now, I gather that scientists apply for and compete for time on the new instrument, and some of them have just begun to use it now that it's effectively been switched on in the last couple of weeks. Is it open to international scientists? Do you know, could Irish scientists and companies be applying for time?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I'm not completely au fait with, you know, how the arrangements work, but certainly these facilities are obviously extremely expensive to build, and so and they're a scarce resource, so people from all around the world will be coming to use this. Whether there's kind of preferential treatment for people from Europe or for people from the UK, I'm not entirely sure, but certainly there will be lots of international scientists using it.
Okay, well, if any Irish scientists are using it, we'd certainly like to hear from you on the Quantum Leap, and our contact details, as always, at the end of the programme. But Dr. James Randison, for now, thank you. And that's the Diamond Synchrotron that's just come into use in England. And you'll find more information about that at their website, which is diamond.ac.uk. You're listening to The Quantum Leap with me, Mary Mulvihill. Still to come, a new book about the problems caused by the fact that our bodies no longer fit the world around us. But first, we're paying a quick visit to the pub.
Tissue engineering, if osteoporosis is the present and hip implants and knee implants are the present, tissue engineering is the future, we believe, of regenerative medicine. And in fact, increasingly, it's the present. And what tissue engineering is, or the goal of tissue engineering, and the formal definition is to develop cell construct and living system technologies to restore the structure and mechanical properties of damaged or degenerated tissue. But in simple terms, what we aim to do is to produce tissue within the lab, preferably with a patient's own cells, own stem cells, and try to implant it back into an injured site.
Now, that was Dr. Fergal O'Brien. He's a bioengineer from the College of Surgeons who has a special interest in bone quality. And once a month, a group of science enthusiasts organises an informal science talk in the bar at Dublin's Mercantile Hotel. They call it the Alchemist Cafe, and we went along to their most recent event when the speaker was Fergal O'Brien. Now, I caught up with him after his talk, but I began by asking the organisers why they spend their time running pub science events.
Hi, I'm Belinda Graham.
Hi, my name is Judith Moffat.
The Alchemist Cafe is an informal science discussion forum. It's where members of the public get the opportunity over a glass of wine or a cup of coffee in an informal setting, not the lecture theatre, to discuss interesting topics in science that they see in the news or they hear about every day, and they never get the opportunity to speak with sort of an expert in the area. So it's very informal.
And so the alchemy is that you're turning science into pub English. Is that it, Judith?
Absolutely. I would have done a Master's in Science Communication and saw that there was a need to bring science to people who are non-specialists. I mean, science forms a large part of our life these days. It's a huge part in society, huge part in industry here. I think it's an important thing for the public to be able to come to.
So who organises this? Are you just a bunch of people who think it's a good idea?
Yes, this is a voluntary thing. Myself, Belinda, Zara and Claire and Nathan organise this. And we come from biology and chemistry backgrounds, and we basically quite enjoy it and organise speakers to come along and get a good kick out of it.
It's an unusual civic activity, Belinda. How long have you been doing it?
Oh, well, the cafe itself has been running since May 2004, and myself and a good few of the other girls have been doing it about, two and a half out of those years. I mean, it was the original science cafe was started by a guy called Duncan Dallas over in Leeds in England in 1998, and he thought that people would like to just talk informally about science in settings such as pubs and cafes, and he saw the need, and it was huge in Leeds, and it spread all over Britain, France, all over Europe basically, America, Australia, they all have cafes. And we thought, or the people I should say that set it up, I wasn't one of the original members, they just saw, why don't we have, we have so much great research going on in Dublin, why don't we have a forum for these people to, you know, talk about what they do with passion, you know.
So it's part of an international movement almost to bring science into pubs. What kind of topics have you had over the couple of years?
We've had global warming, and we've also had poetry and science, and we've also had Cosmic rays has been another topic as well.
Stem cell research, that was a huge one. Yeah. We've had lots of different topics. We had Ger Fleming, a well-known weatherman, was talking about the communication of topics such as meteorology to the public and how there's an awful lot of science behind what you see after the evening news. So he was brilliant and he was very enthusiastic about the cafe.
And of course we'll be hearing from Gerry Fleming later in the programme as our regular look at the weather. Who comes to these?
Basically, at first we noticed it was mostly people who were involved in science, but as word spread and as the topics became broader, we've noticed a huge general public interest, which is really our target. I mean, that's where we really want to get the interest and get the involvement, so we've been really pleased with that.
And if the public want to find out when and where the next one is happening, where do they go?
Check out our website.
Our website, absolutely. It's www.alchemistcafedublin.com, and you'll be able to see the latest events there and also have a look at our past events.
Well, why don't we find out who some of the people are who came this evening? Can I just ask you why you've come to this pub science?
I just thought it might be interesting. I'm doing mechanical engineering, and this is the kind of area that I want to go into. So.
I really want to do medicine, so my dad heard about this. He got an email, so I just sort of came along to see what it's all about, really. So.
We studied science in college.
And you didn't get enough of it?
No, I didn't get enough of it, no. We live and breathe science. Woo!
We read in the National Geographic that Canadians are starting to put human bones into beavers, and we wanted to know, did he know anything about that?
Dr. Fergal O'Brien from the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland, you gave tonight's presentation at the Alchemist Cafe. They've now served the finger food. They're taking a little break. I gather there wouldn't normally be finger food at one of your talks. Why would you make a presentation like this in a bar in Dublin?
Well, I think it's absolutely fantastic. I was invited by the Alchemist Cafe about 6 weeks ago to see what I'd be interested in giving this talk. And one of the big attractions is that it is in an informal environment, such as a bar, such as the Mercantile here in Dublin, which means that people from the general public to people from other universities can come in and see what science and what engineering is all about. And I think this is so important to try and focus and try and promote science and technology in Ireland.
Your talk this evening, you looked at reasons why bones break and osteoporosis and some of the current techniques and some of the new techniques to treat it. And we were able to, you were passing around in the audience, hip implants, knee implants, and some new ways of growing cells in the laboratory. Is that very different to a lecture that you would give conventionally? Did you have to change your style for the setting?
I can be honest, it was very different, because I think most lecturers feel most comfortable when they've got a screen behind them or they've got an overhead projector or a blackboard and they can point out things. And I was told by the Alchemist Cafe that they don't want this. They want it to be an informal structure, so they don't want people to be pointing at slides and referring to technical data and so on to try and keep it at a certain level. But I must say, I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed how interactive the audience seemed to be.
Will you be doing more of this? Are you going to be taking your science into supermarkets and shopping malls?
Well, if the opportunity arose, I do it from time to time, going into schools to try and sell engineering and sell science to some of the schools. One of the things I'm very interested in tonight is that a number of the undergraduate medical students that I teach in the College of Surgeons are here. In fact, I see 10, 15 of them there at the moment. So it's great to see that the doctors of the future are coming down to see what the research, the ongoing research, is all about.
The Alchemist Cafe meets once a month in a Dublin city bar, and you'll find more information at their website, alchemistcafedublin.com. Now, a new book sets out to examine how our bodies no longer fit the world around us. It's called Mismatch. It's about how we evolved for a kind of hunter-gatherer lifestyle over 100,000 years ago. And therefore, our bodies aren't really designed for sedentary 21st century living when you don't have to hunt for your dinner and high-energy food is everywhere, the result being, among other things, diseases such as diabetes. And the book is written by two medical scientists, Peter Brookman and Mark Hansen. And joining me from our Belfast studio to discuss the book is Niamh Shaw, an actor, a comedian, an engineer and a food scientist. Niamh, I've tried to summarise this mismatch concept in a few words here. Maybe it would help if you could give us a few of the examples of the kind of mismatch that the authors talk about.
Okay, well, basically they say that we're designed for a specific comfort zone, and we thrive within these regions. So, for example, if you move then to a very cold climate, that's going to have an effect on your body. And about two or three generations down the way, the effects of that are going to affect your offspring. And a very good example he gave was the Sherpas in the Himalayas, that they're excellent at adapting to the high altitude, and they have excellent lung capacity, but because of living in that environment, there was very low iodine in the vegetation. And what started happening about two or three generations from the Sherpas living up there was that they started to develop goiter, and some children then were born with cretinism, which is basically a brain defect
caused by iodine deficiency.
Iodine deficiency. So when the Westerners started coming to visit the Himalayas, they started bringing with them, you know, food that was rich in iodine. And the Sherpas would bring this food home to their families. And it was found just accidentally that when they were fed the westernized food, that the iodine deficiency disappeared. And then the next offspring was perfectly healthy. And there was one particular Sherpa who, over a number of years, developed a relationship with a particular group and brought home more and more and more food. So the first child had cretinism, the second child had goiter, and the third child, there was no deficiency of iodine in the mother, so the child was perfectly normal.
Okay, intriguing. Mm. What about the kind of mismatch that we might see in Ireland in a kind of westernised society?
Well, he goes on a lot about, because the two of them have a background in paediatrics, they go on a lot about how we adjust within the fetus to our environment. So if you're reared, if your mother is malnourished while she's pregnant carrying you or an infant, the infant adapts in the womb to expect a lifestyle where there's going to be, not a lot of food around. So what happens is that the body adjusts to have a very short lifespan, and also it expects to have food which is of low nutritional value. So if you put that child then into modern society where it has access to, high energy foods, fast foods, it's much more likely to develop diabetes or obesity or heart disease, because the body has been adjusted basically in the womb to expect a very different environment to the one in which it's been put into.
So the metabolism is kind of programmed by what it experiences in the womb.
Yeah.
Some of these mismatches, in fact, I think most of them develop, it seems, because our environment and in particular our diet changes faster than our bodies can evolve in response to them. What kind of conclusions do the authors draw? I mean, are they saying that we as a species are doomed to more and more lifestyle problems?
Their conclusions are vague enough, but they basically say that if you're looking at, if you're studying evolution, you have to not just study, the nature versus nurture, which is looking at the genes and the environment. There's a third factor, which is that we adapt to our environment, and that should be something that should be looked at. It also gives recommendations that, again, they're very much on the procreative side of life, that if you're pregnant, you shouldn't smoke, because that's going to have implications on further generations. He makes a very valid point about teenage pregnancies, because if teenagers have babies, they're not actually fully developed, and that actually will affect the growth of the fetus, and it'll also send signals to expect again an environment which does not match the environment of the modern world, and that has implications three or four generations down the way. He also says that we weren't actually designed to survive as long as we are. And the long-term effects of that would be, in about 30 or 40 years' time, we're going to have a society with a lot of elderly. That's going to put a greater stress on the healthcare system and less on, the obstetrics and gynaecology area. So that's going to take our focus off where we should be looking, which is into future generations. So we're kind of reeling from this rapid change in our environment. He also says that teenagers are kind of at a disadvantage at the moment because of the excellent diet that they have. They are maturing physically very quickly, so that they're sexually mature, but they're not actually socially mature, which is that if you look at 1400, 1500, a person at the age of 15 years of age was actually, married and holding the family down, responsibilities. But because society is so complicated now, with so many things to learn and to adjust to, there's this mismatch in teenagers that they're sexually mature, but they're not socially mature, so they're not actually able to take on the responsibilities of an adult, even though their bodies are telling them that they're an adult.
I found that aspect actually myself very thought-provoking,
yeah.
That we worry about obesity and diabetes and
yeah.
so forth, but actually one of the problems or one of the consequences of diet and modern living is girls maturing
yeah.
Earlier. Mm-hmm. Did it convince you, Niamh? Were you, you know, did it make sense to you? Was it thought-provoking?
In parts it was thought-provoking, but the way the book is written, it's quite repetitious, which is unfortunate, because I think if they could have made the book maybe 50%, if they have edited about 50% of it, I think that the point would have come across a lot more easily.
Right. It is 200 pages of fairly detailed argument and another 50 pages of notes and not an illustration or a diagram of any kind.
I think an illustration or a diagram would have helped. Something also that I'm confused about is I don't know who this book is marketed to, because if it's marketed to scientists, it's far too vernacular in its use of language for a scientist to be happy. A scientist usually needs like an objective, the experimental procedure, the results and the discussion, and it has to kind of take that format. If it's directed at popular science, it's not concise enough. It doesn't have enough sort of key information points for somebody who's just reading it to pick it up very quickly. So I'm not really sure who it's directed
at. Okay, so some thought-provoking things, but maybe one to borrow from the library and
yeah.
not to buy.
Yes.
We've been discussing Mismatch. It's subtitled Why Our World No Longer Fits Our Bodies by Peter Gluckman and Mark Hansen. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press, priced at £17 sterling. And Niamh Shaw in Belfast, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mary.
Now, time for our weekly look at the world around us. And this week, we're turning our attention to the somewhat unsettled spring weather. Joining me on the line is Met Air and meteorologist Gerry Fleming. Gerry, first, a question of definitions, because we're going to ask you about spring weather. And then I thought, I think spring starts on the 1st of February. And then I wondered, when does spring start for meteorologists?
For us in the Met Service, for meteorologists everywhere, spring starts in the Northern Hemisphere, of course, on the 1st of March. Now, there's no such thing as an official definition of spring. If you're going to judge it by hours of sunlight and so on, winter will be the months of November, December, January. But if you judge it by temperature, which is what we do, then winter are the months of December, January and February. And then consequently summer months are June, July and August, which is kind of typical of what we all expect summer to be, because temperature lags the hours of sunshine by 3 or 4 weeks. And indeed, if you were a dolphin, you'd say spring doesn't even start until the 1st of April, because the sea temperatures take a little bit longer to actually get up. So that's another aspect to it.
Very good. So while I've been having spring weather for the last month, spring is only starting for you today on the 1st of March. This current unsettled weather, is that typical for this time of year? I mean, do we kind of see a tussle between winter going out, summer trying to come in?
We certainly do. I mean, in the winter months, we have these westerly winds come across the country from the Atlantic, and they're sweeping across with great ferocity, of course, at times over the past 2 or 3 months, as we know. When we get into spring, the weather patterns change a little bit, and the high pressure over Siberia tends to be stronger and tends to push easterly winds across North and Central Europe, and at times those easterly winds reach us. Now, when they do reach us, they're very dry and very cold and quite bitter winds, so they tend to be a phenomenon of March particularly, and sometimes on into April as well. And of course, they're a problem for gardeners, especially because the spring has tempted lots of little plants to shove their heads above the soil and so on, and then this east wind comes and really scours them out of it, as we say down in Wexford.
And the unsettled patterns, I mean, is that a kind of a tussle going on between weather systems?
Because you've got the westerlies coming in, trying to push their way in from the Atlantic. You've got the easterlies pushing their way across from the Siberian anticyclone. In between, you have the weather fronts, and they get pushed backwards and forwards across Ireland at this time of year quite regularly, which I suppose we've had weather fronts across us, of course, a lot over the course of the winter, but generally over the winter, they've been coming from the west. They've been part of that very strong westerly wind, which really sweeps across the Atlantic during the winter months and which brought us so many storms in the past while.
And speaking of winds, March winds, is it true? Is March particularly windy?
It's a fairly windy month from the east. I think it's the fact that the winds, when they do come, because they're cold and dry, they're very noticeable, I suppose, because they really are quite bitter. So because the air is cold and dry, the effect of the wind adds a lot to the wind chill, I suppose. When the air is more moist and humid, as it typically is coming from the Atlantic, the winds don't have that same very strong effect on us. Of course, we feel the wind, but we don't feel the temperature, if you like, to such an extent that they don't cool us down to the same extent as those very cold, dry winds. So I think it's the fact that the winds in March are more noticeable to our poor puny humans trying to keep our body temperatures up at 38 degrees Celsius or whatever.
Very good. Jerry Fleming from Met Air, and thank you very much. And finally, a reminder in case you haven't heard, there's going to be a total eclipse of the moon this Saturday night at about 11 p.m. So if the skies are clear, you should see the moon turn a warm red colour as it moves into the Earth's shadow. Well, that's it for this week. You'll find more information about the items in this week's programme on our website at rte.ie/radio1/quantum. And if you'd like to contact us, you can drop us an email to quantum@rte.ie. But from me, Mary Mulville, until next week, Sláinte Thomas.